Hello and welcome to CityWire's Funds Fanatic Show. My name is Jeremy Gordon and I'm very pleased to be joined on the podcast today by economist and author Joe Studwell. Joe is a director on the board of the Pacific Horizon Investment Trust run by Baillie Gifford, but I must confess before I stumbled across that fact, he was best known to me as author of How Asia Works, an iconoclastic 2013 study of development in the region. The latest of several books he's written on similar themes, this gave the clearest explanation I've yet come across for why, say, South Korea went from mid-century economic destitution to effectively catching up with Western countries, while Southeast Asian countries like the Philippines did not. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. So I'm conscious I've introduced you by mentioning a book which actually came out in 2013. Maybe to bring us up to date a bit with what you're up to, I can start by asking, what's your day job, so to speak, at the moment?
That's a good question. What is my day job? My day job is writing a book at the moment on Africa. I did a PhD in between that last book, How Asia Works, and this new book, which is why I haven't had a book out for a good number of years. Then I do one or two other things as well. I do a bit of consulting. And as you mentioned, I have this non-executive director position at Pacific Horizon, which is a Asia ex Japan investment trust. And that's been very interesting.
Okay. Well, great. Certainly lots for us to come back to there. But maybe you can start by telling us a bit more about your connection with Baillie Gifford, as you've just mentioned.
Well, before I started on the board of Pacific Horizon, I knew Baillie Gifford a little bit, but only in the way that I'd come to know a lot of fund management businesses over the years from having worked for about 25 years in East Asia, and books that I'd written and things I'd written as a journalist had led them to ask me a few times to go and give talks, you know, just like giving talks for other people. So there was no greater connection than that, really. I suppose the only other thing for me was I always enjoyed going to Edinburgh. I was like the sort of culture of the Edinburgh financial services industry, which I think is a bit different to what you get in London.
That's interesting. I mean, what's it like going into these asset managers? I suppose what's the experience like? Are the fund managers trooping into the room with enthusiasm, or how's it normally work?
Yeah, I mean, Baillie Gifford people. I mean, I remember when talks I gave there; they were always very well attended. I don't know whether people were forced to turn up, but hopefully not. And it's very research driven. Place and and you meet very smart people there. And it's less, you know, it's in my experience, it's purely my experience, just less frenetic than I would say things feel when you go into a lot of investment businesses in the city in London.
Okay, that's interesting. And so we've mentioned How Asia Works and another book you wrote called Asian Godfathers, which is more about sort of oligarchs and developmental failure in Southeast Asia, I think, are on the reading list for Baillie Gifford's graduate scheme you've mentioned before, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, unfortunately so. I've blighted the lives of a generation of Baillie Gifford research people. They're still, as I understand it, they're still made to read these books and frequently complain about having to read things that were published so long ago. Can't we read something new?
Yeah, we were speculating a bit before about whatever it is, but they want to read that's newer. I'm not sure myself. Now, we probably won't be discussing Pacific Horizon, which, as you said, has been a really successful Asia Pacific ex Japan fund directly too much today. But I suppose broadly, what's being a director on the trust involve?
Well, I mean, for me, it was incredibly interesting when I joined because I'd never thought that I would do anything like this. I'd no experience of it. And the board, as I joined it originally, you know, what was striking was that everybody was fantastically good at running a listed company, but there wasn't really that much expertise on the part of the world that we were investing in. Mm. And I think that's not particularly unusual. Joining, I thought, well, what can I do that's useful? And what I've enjoyed the most is conversations with the managers, really, about companies and countries and governments where we're invested, you have to be very careful because, of course, you can't and you don't want to be seen to be providing anything that could constitute advice to the managers or pushing them in any direction. But just having an interaction which you know challenges them on a regular basis and hopefully just creates just expands the base of knowledge on all sides. And that's the part that I really that I've really enjoyed. And to be fair to the managers, they've been fantastic because they, at least based on what they've said, they've enjoyed it as well. And they've liked having someone who's just on a day-to-day basis. Well, less so now, as I say, doing Africa, but generally in the over the years, who's been immersed on a day-to-day basis in the stuff that they're dealing with.
That's interesting. How often do you talk to them?
Obviously you talk to them when you go and have board meetings, but I, over the time I've been doing it, I've just had sort of infrequent but regular bilaterals with them. And we'll just go through a particular country and we'll say, well, what do you think's going on here? And talk about some of the countries. And then I'm asking a lot of questions because obviously with the companies, they will know far more than I do because they've drilled down in enormous depth before they make some decisions. It's just nice to interact with people who are really, really, really research driven.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back to some of that, but I suppose turning to your own work a bit more, maybe it makes sense to start by rewinding about three decades or so to when you first went to China. What were you doing when you first went out there?
I was following my wife. She made me go to China. She'd read Chinese. So at the time when I arrived we arrived in Hong Kong first and then 18 months later went up to Beijing. So yeah. I didn't speak any Chinese. Then spent years and years struggling with that language. Thoroughly enjoyed the whole experience. But I think that for me, although we were based for almost a decade in Beijing, in all the time that I was there, I was always interested in the region and how the region was developing. And so I did a fair amount of magazine writing. So I'd go and do magazine pieces in different countries in the region.
And that's for people like The Economist, right?
For the Economist Intelligence Unit, I did a lot of work. I did odd things for The Economist. I did things for the Asian Wall Street Journal, for the FT, and for a local regional business magazine called Asia Inc. And it was all business, finance, economic stuff, because that was what the market was, the journalistic market was. Slowly got to know the region and read into the histories of the different countries in the region. I had done history as an undergraduate degree, so I had some knowledge. I just became fascinated by the different rates and different models of development that you could see.
Okay, and also I think you founded an academic journal called China Economic Quarterly, which is still going, I believe, and that also grew into Dragonomics, right, which then morphed into Gavkow Dragonomics, which is quite a well-known research house in Asia.
Yeah, so that was 97. I was living in China from 93, and it was all the sort of pure journalism until 97. And then I started the China Economic Quarterly, which was the basis of the sort of initial research product for Dragonomics, which, as you say, became Gavkow Dragonomics when I left in 2007. It's a macro research business and it's done pretty well.
When you first went out there, you said, I think you moved to mainland China in 1993, around then, you said. I mean, can you give us a sense of what some of the other characters you were meeting? I mean, You've also written a book called The China Dream, which is about this kind of foreign investment gold rush in China in the 1990s.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it was in those first few years, because if you think back, 1992 was Deng Xiaoping's southern tour, as it was called, you know, when he came out after the Tiananmen massacre 3 years after that and said, right, we need to get back to growth. And there was pretty universal support for that desire to get back to rapid growth. And that coincided with a gold rush by foreign companies. I think, you know, because if you're running a multinational business, you looked at China in the 90s and you said, well, you know, if this country is going to grow at 10% a year, it will be a huge part of the business that my company does. And the logic of that was absolutely correct. But as is often the case with investment decisions, the timing wasn't necessarily perfect. And so what you had in the early and mid-90s was a lot of foreign businesses, multinational businesses and investment businesses piling into China at a time when the economy was still actually surprisingly small when you looked at it in hard terms. I mean, when I arrived in 1993, for instance, the GDP per capita in current dollars was 340 per person.
Wow.
Which is like, you know, less than half of what Ethiopia is today. I mean, again in current money, but you know, today China's at approximately 10,000. So there was, I would say, a decade really of foreign investors pouring money into China and then finding that there wasn't really the business yet to be done that the scale of their investments required.
Okay. And so at what point do you realize there's this this yawning gap really between the reality of why countries like Japan, Taiwan, and then, you know, while you were there really, China began to become developmentally successful, versus the kind of what's sometimes called the Washington consensus of free markets and deregulation, which has led quite a lot of other developing countries to make not much progress, really?
Well, I mean, I think all the work I did in Southeast Asia led me in that direction. The Asian Godfathers book, which is really about the oligarchs of Southeast Asia and poses the question, well, why are these economies dominated by these oligarch types who don't really exist in places like China and Japan and Korea.
Right.
So that work and that book, you know, led me to a view that actually what you've got here is an essentially bifurcated region of the world in terms of economic development. I mean, none of it is really a failure. I mean, Southeast Asia is, you know, if you start to compare with Africa, still looks pretty successful. But if you look within East Asia, the difference is enormous between Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia. It's the difference between countries in one and a half generations going to highly developed levels of GDP per capita in countries that remain, you know, in the middle income area, or at least as defined by the World Bank. And so I started to ask, you know, why are the outcomes so different? And that's what led me to the framework of How Asia Works and the focus on these three critical variables, which are the agriculture one, in particular, whether there'd been land reform, which divided one group of countries in East Asia from another, on the role of manufacturing and on how the financial system was organized.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about agriculture and land reform at first, maybe. I mean, I think probably at the words land reform, lots of people's ears will perk up. You know, maybe, I mean, you know, using an example, if you like, Can you explain to us what happened in some of these East Asian countries after the Second World War and why it was so important?
Yeah, all of the most successful East Asian countries, which is to say Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, and now following Vietnam,
had, okay,
universal land reforms, which means that agricultural land was taken in hand by government and chopped up pretty much equally, or at least equally based on what it would render in terms of its yield, among the farming population. And this happened in these countries because at the end of the Second World War, unequal access to land and landlessness were so significant that they were threatening to tear countries apart and threatening to lead to just a breakdown in societies. So starting with Japan, where the US eventually concluded it needed to demand that the emperor put land reform in train, and then going on to Korea and to Taiwan, where it happened a little later, and to China, where it happened by means of the Communist Party revolution and was done about 3 years after the 1949 liberation, and similarly in Vietnam, where it happened with the Communist Party in Vietnam. In all of these places, agricultural land was chopped up, as I say, pretty much equally among the farming population. It wasn't just about that. It was also about providing extension support, which is to say telling people, you know, you've got to plant the seeds this deep and this far apart and water them on this day, and this is the mix of fertilizer you need, and then providing all the inputs in terms of fertilizer and the right seeds and so forth. But if you put all that together with everybody having a bit of land, what it turned out to be the case was that the agricultural productivity in these countries became way higher than it had been with larger scale farms. That sounds absolutely crazy, because we always imagine that there are returns to scale, because I suppose we think of manufacturing and we just translate that into agriculture. But in fact, if you've got very large numbers of very poor people, in other words, very cheap people, and you turn agriculture into a sort of glorified form of gardening, and you garden incredibly intensively with all these people, and you use vertical trellising and put polythene over everything so that you can maximize the growth that you produce, you can actually produce more off the land than you can at scale farming. The reason you don't do it in rich countries is because people cost too much. But in East Asia, it was incredibly, incredibly effective and led to massive yield gains. And not only that, the yield gains that were produced were very evenly spread through society. So everybody had not much money, but a little bit of money. And this created a demand profile in these countries that meant that what people would purchase was very basic consumer goods and construction materials that could be manufactured locally. You know, so farmers, they found, well, they purchased things like very basic household utensils, but they would purchase cement, they would purchase glass, they would purchase bricks, and all of this stuff started to be manufactured domestically at large scale. And that began the transformation in manufacturing, which in the book I argued was the second defining characteristic of the most successful countries, that they then, in policy terms, they overemphasized the role of manufacturing.
Okay, and in particular, so that, yeah, that leads us on to the manufacturing piece. In particular, it wasn't just manufacturing, it was export-driven manufacturing, is that right?
So export-driven manufacturing is important because in order to overemphasize the role of manufacturing, these governments gave subsidies, very large subsidies,
usually through the banking system in the form of cheap credit. And normally when firms get subsidies, it's an invitation to take the money and not do what they've been asked to do. But what happened in East Asia and was very effective was that the subsidies in the form of cheap credit were provisioned on the basis of exports. And you got your cheap credit by showing your bank your export documentation, and the banks in turn would issue cheap credit against the letters of credit that were issued for exports. And this became very effective because it meant that you couldn't very easily cheat the system. Most people didn't cheat the system. They produced globally competitive goods using the cheap credit that they were supplied by financial systems that were organized in such a way to do this. And as I said in the book, I mean, if you want to look at the sort of degree of overemphasis of manufacturing in these countries, what you find is that as a rule of thumb, about a third of the workforce comes to work in manufacturing at the sort of peak point, which is approximately where China is now. And if you look at countries that don't use a proactive industrial policy in the same way, and India would be an obvious example in Asia, then you'll see that in India it's about 14% of the population works in manufacturing. So in effect, these countries doubled the share of the population that was employed in the manufacturing sector.
And I suppose why is that so important? Why is there no other way to do it, such as having a more kind of maybe a more consumption led growth boom, for example?
Well, the way it's put by economists is that there's no other automatic escalator for productivity convergence. So what this means is that only manufacturing can be shown as a sector of the economy to take people who are coming out of agriculture originally largely and bring them into the modern economy and increase their levels of productivity to what they are in developed countries in an essentially automatic fashion. And I mean, if you think about services, so I mean, you'll see in some countries in Africa now people say, oh, well, you know, they're not going to do manufacturing, they're going to develop through a services economy. But if you think about services and compare them with manufacturing, you know, in manufacturing you can arrive in a factory where most of the technical capability is vested in machines. So you go and use the machine to produce something, and you can arrive there and you can start sweeping the floor on day one or week one, and the next week you do something else and something else, and they will bring you into the production process, and you will gradually upskill. In services, it's often not like that. You know, if you want, for instance, to have people who are going to go and work in call centers using a language that's not their first language, I mean, they can't turn up the first week with a bit of English and start working, and then, you know, the next month have a bit more and so on. You know, you've got to get over a hurdle in order to be able to do the job. And it's the same, you know, if you want to be software coding or something like that. And a lot of services jobs are of that nature. That they have skill hurdles, and you just can't get in the game until you've got over that hurdle. And there are other reasons as well, but there's something very special about manufacturing. And if you want to sort of look at it historically, no country other than very small offshore financial centers, and even then, usually not even then, no country has gone the whole way through the development process without having a significant manufacturing sector.
Okay. And so something else that occurred to me was often for these countries, say for Japan or Korea, an important symbolic moment, really, well, not just symbolic, is when they start to develop an auto industry, a car industry. Is that still going to be the same in case in the future, or will there be a kind of new symbolic manufacturing industry which kind of shows a country's arrived, so to speak?
I think automotive will continue to be very important because there are so many parts in cars. I mean, there are a lot fewer parts in electric cars than there are in internal combustion engine cars, but nonetheless, they're complex products. And so, and they're complex products and they're very, very widely consumed. And so they are an obvious technology for a developing country to aim to have. And yeah, so I imagine it will continue.
Okay, the car is still king, developmentally.
I think the car's going to continue in one form or other to be king for a long time. And also because, of course, you know, when you start to produce cars, you've got to have very high quality steel. So it places requirements on your steel industry to really be at the cutting edge. Or, you know, at the forefront of world standards of production. So I think same old. And that, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, and it goes on all the time. And I think, you know, even a few years ago, I was hearing it more again. People were saying, oh, you know, development is not going to be the same. It's going to be different. But the reality is that so far, for the last 250 years, everybody has gone down what the Japanese call the same bends in the river, meaning that they've all had to do steel, they've all had to do cement, they've all had to do you know, and so on.
Right. Unless you're Hong Kong or something, there's really no alternative.
Hong Kong's growth and employment were critically dependent in the 50s and 60s on its textiles and other processing industries, and they then sort of disappeared over the border into China, so people kind of forgot about them. I mean, Singapore has the highest manufacturing value added per capita in East Asia.
Really?
Yeah. Part of that, I think, is down to the role of the, you know, they have a significant petrochemicals industry which is put into that. Into that calculation, but Singapore has significant. Most of it's foreign owned. Most of most of the companies are foreign, but it's still there.
Okay, and so we've got these first two bits of the puzzle in terms of agriculture and land reform, and then manufacturing, and the third bit of the puzzle is that really the financial sector is marshaled to support these other two factors, rather than sort of running away with itself in a festival of deregulation and free market economics and so on. Is that right, or have I mischaracterized that?
Yeah, you know, once you've decided that you're going to be the so-called developmental state, and you're going to organize agriculture and manufacturing to be massively more productive than they otherwise would be, you want control of the money that is potentially at your disposal. And so that's why all of the most successful countries in East Asia did the opposite of what the IMF and the World Bank recommended with financial sectors. They all maintained capital controls for a long time. China and Vietnam still got them. And they operated banking systems that were very closely controlled by governments, either because they were dominated by state-owned banks, like in China, or they were private banking systems, but very heavily controlled by government, as in Japan. That's the picture. Is that it, you know, money is therefore effectively trapped in the domestic economy, and the government can allocate it to the ends that it thinks are the right ones for the country's development.
Yeah, and I suppose in light of that, equity markets, debt markets, where they come up in how Asia works, it's normally in a less than positive light. At best, they don't derail the development process. Can you help square the circle a bit when it comes to thinking about investing in Asia? And do you have a certain ambivalence about outside investment in Asia?
I think from a developmental point of view, I don't think it's the case anymore because the IMF in particular has changed its tune on many of these issues. But it was the case in the 1990s, in particular, that things like stock markets were foisted on developing countries as being, you know, fundamental to the early stage of growth. Well, stock markets are difficult, complex things to run. And it's not a bad idea to sort of get going, trying to run a stock market in a small sort of way at an early stage. But it's absolutely not something, I think, that is going to be a significant element in the early development of a country. And such was the case in places like China and Japan, where governments kept stock markets on a very small scale for a very long time. In contrast to a country like Malaysia, where the capitalization of the Malaysian stock market was already more than 3.5 times GDP, which is a ridiculous level by international comparative standards back in the 1990s. And that was really because, you know, I think that Mahathir's government had bought into a lot of this propaganda, and they thought the most important thing for them to do was try and compete with the Singaporean stock market.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I suppose it all ends in the Asian financial crisis in 1997. Another way of maybe looking at a similar kind of question really is, Asia's high growth rates and growth potential are frequently cited as reasons for investing there. But, you know, does that actually make historical or contemporary sense?
That's an interesting question. And yes, I mean, you know, if you look at Asia since the Asian financial crisis that started in 1997, the best place to invest after 1997, the best region to invest for the next 10-15 years was Southeast Asia. Well, Southeast Asia had pretty depressed economic growth in that period. So why was it a good place to invest? Well, because they took the medicine from the IMF and the World Bank, if they hadn't already been gotten rid of, capital controls completely ended. You had thoroughly privatized banking systems, and you had banking systems that were pushing out consumer credit. And these economies started to produce very profitable financial sector businesses and consumer businesses that produced fantastic returns for people who put money into them. And if you look in contrast at what was going on in Northeast Asia, or most obviously in China, all through this period, China's growing at 10% or 10% plus a year. But the returns in the stock market were nothing like as good. Well, why is this? And the answer, I think, is for exactly the reasons that I was describing before, that you've got a financial system that is set up, that is pumping money and cheap credit into the manufacturing sector and other parts of the economy that are the developmental state targets. And what you actually tend to get is huge amounts of overcapacity in many areas, which translate into poor returns in terms of profit, but very good returns in terms of technological learning. So by which I mean that these firms are improving their capability to produce more complex products year after year after year. But as an investor, your interests are absolutely not aligned with those of the developmental state. Because as an investor, you want your cake today. You want to have your cake today and you want to eat it. The developmental state is saying, No. We're not having any cake today or tomorrow. We're having it in many years' time, but it'll be a nicer cake. Well, that doesn't really work for a portfolio investor, because although everybody in the investing world says that they're, you know, they're into patient capital and all the rest of it, no one's into capital that's so patient that it's going to wait 10 or 15 years or 20 years as you had to get good stock market returns in countries like China and Japan.
Mm. Okay. I mean, while you're speaking there, I was thinking about India, you know, for Indian equity fund managers or again, emerging markets fund managers, often India's banks are kind of seen as one of the hottest bets. And so that kind of thing, it's a signal that maybe it's, you know, it could be a good few years for investors, but it doesn't herald such a good thing for Indian development then.
India over the last couple of decades has always been a better place for portfolio investors than many of the Northeast Asian countries. And that's because, you know, I was saying it hasn't had real industrial policy in place, and it hasn't had real financial repression in place. And yes, as you say, that can be good for portfolio investors, not necessarily so good for India's development, and hasn't been, you know, so good for India's development, because, you know, the proof is that when you look at India's economy with just about the same population as China's, it's a quarter of the size of the Chinese economy. And that is the difference in the policies that they've been able to apply.
Mm, okay. And so let's come on a bit to your more your recent interest in Africa. I think, you know, partly sponsored by the Gates Foundation, you know, Bill Gates' foundation, you've been applying a lot of this same thinking to various African countries. What have been some of the main lessons there so far?
I think Africa's is very interesting because it's so different to East Asia at a demographic level. So in How Asia Works, I said at the beginning of the book, I'm not really going to talk about demographics because the growth of populations has been so consistent across the region, particularly since the Second World War, and has population densities have been what's been required for rapid development. Africa, by contrast, has been of major areas of our planet the most consistently underpopulated part of the world. And even at the end of the decade we're in now, at the end of this decade, population density in Africa will still only be what it was in Asia in 1950. Which may seem incredible because you see loads of stories in the media about, it looks like there's teeming numbers of people in Nigeria or whatever. But actually, if you look at the continent as a whole, it remains well below what I would say is an optimum population level for rapid development. So that's the first thing that's set Africa apart. And then the second thing is just starting at a significantly lower level in terms of human capital. If you go back to 1950, 1960, I mean, we often hear about how illiteracy rates in Korea were half of the population. But when you get into Africa, you look at countries which at independence, you know, had 20 people who'd been to university in the whole country. So, and then if you look at illiteracy, you know, illiteracy being the norm in many African countries. So those are different things from East Asia. But what is the same is that we have two very small African territories that have done rapid economic development. And one in particular has used policies which are very familiar from East Asia. So the two are Botswana and Mauritius. Mauritius, the island east of Madagascar. And Botswana really profited just through governance. I mean, it happens to be a giant diamond mine, or to have a small number of very, very richly endowed diamond mines. And Botswana is just really a country where people found a way to work together developed the diamond mines that they have there, and just put the money into roads and into education and produce growth around 8% over a long period of time. Mauritius is different because, as I say, more like an East Asian experience, because they had a very clever agricultural policy. I mean, it's a monocrop culture of sugarcane, but they had a very well thought through policy to support smallholders at the same time as leaving in place some large sugar estates, but taxing them very heavily and using that money to promote developmental policy. And it's really the only place in Africa that has put in place an effective manufacturing strategy and took unemployment from 25% of the working population to zero in the course of the 1980s in just 10 years, and did the usual things with manipulating finance as well. The problem is that they're both, you know, countries of 1 to 2 million people. So on a continent of over a billion people now, that doesn't really give you evidence, about what is going to happen to more populous countries. What we had been starting to see, and everyone, well, many people in the development sector were very excited about, was agricultural policy and manufacturing strategy in Ethiopia.
Okay.
That are very much in line with East Asian experience and would seem to be starting to produce similar results. But as I'm sure you know, Ethiopia then in the last couple of years has fallen into a civil war, which is in a sort of truce now, but has been a very sad end or intermission, we don't know what it'll turn out to be, to what looked like the first case of a large population African state moving into rapid economic development. And there's almost 120 million people in Ethiopia today. But we have to wait and see what's going to happen there. But they were doing very well in increasing agricultural productivity. There'd been a land reform there. They were very, very focused on agricultural development and then started building industrial parks and bringing in Chinese, Turkish, and Indian low value added but high employment firms in textile, in garments, and other sectors to create jobs. But like many places in Africa, Ethiopia is a place where a lot of tensions exist on ethnic lines, and that's exactly what has happened. I mean, they've had an ethnic civil war.
Okay. All in all, then, it sounds like, unfortunately, not that many causes for optimism, really. I suppose something I wanted to return to was I was skimming the conclusion of how Asia works for speaking to you. And slightly bleakly, you raise the prospect, or you ask the question, would we see a repeat of the kind of rapid development of countries like Japan and Korea and Taiwan again? And you said possibly not. And an important reason was because land reform is so off the political agenda. Splitting up the some of the big inefficient farming estates in lots of countries. Can you speak about that a bit more and why it's what clearly once was an acceptable idea in developing countries has fallen away?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very difficult to be taking agricultural land off people and divvying it up. And what happened in the Northeast Asian countries after the Second World war happened in a very particular context, that it was after the Second World War when 50-odd million people had died. A country like Japan was occupied by the United States until 1952. South Korea was occupied as well. And Taiwan was not officially occupied, but it was very much under US sway. So it was possible in that time to make these very bold decisions and get away with them. And in China and in Vietnam, of course, the land reforms there were done by victorious communist parties who, well, in the case of the Chinese, one, you know, Mao famously said it wasn't a bad thing if one landlord in every village was killed, you know, to send a political message. So this stuff was not done in a gentle kind of way. And similarly, I mean, you know, just talking there about Ethiopia, the land reform that was done in Ethiopia was done after the overthrow of Haile Selassie by a Maoist regime. And yeah, it was very effective. And the current Ethiopian government has built on that and increased agricultural productivity. And it's all worked out very well. But again, it was not a thing that was done happily and voluntarily by everyone. So I think that as we've gotten further away from that particular, particularly from the context of the post-Second World War era, land reform has tended to get further off the agenda just because, you know, people say, well, how are you actually going to do this? And there was a time in the 1960s, I mean, the Kennedy government had a go at sort of pushing for it again. But what happened more in the 60s was that there were more sort of half-hearted land reform attempts, or there were lots of exemptions to try and make them more reasonable and so on. The results were not great. So I suppose key lesson that we've seen in land reform is that you either do it and do it completely, or anything that's sort of in the middle tends not to work anything like as well.
Okay, and I suppose maybe we can finish on China, as I suppose that's maybe where it kind of begins for you. I mean, what do you think some of the most important economic or societal trends going on in China are right now? Is it still the same story as we've been discussing, or is something shifting?
Well, I mean, to my mind, you know, China has gotten, you know, China's gotten so far into its economic development that, you know, politics starts to become more important. I think that, you know, certainly when I lived there in the 90s and through the 2000s, the economy was growing very fast and people were absolutely happy to accept, you know, the trade-off that the Communist Party tacitly offered them, which is essentially don't make trouble and, you know, we'll all get richer and richer. I just think that when you're at $10,000 GDP per capita, it starts to be a little different. And certainly that level of income is similar to where, for instance, Korea was at in the mid-80s, which is when people started to feel that they'd had enough of the military governments there. So I don't know, but China, of course, is also different because it's such a huge country and the domestic market is so huge that it can afford to behave in an insular way to an extent that just isn't possible for a lower population country. And we'll see. And it's terribly difficult to, you know, I suppose as someone who lived there, I've been amazed by how under Xi Jinping, China has become just so much more closed, you know, to the point where it's become incredibly difficult to speak, you know, even, for instance, to professors at Chinese universities, you know, people you'd think that you could turn to for a conversation about what's going on with this and what's going on. You know, it really has become a place where no one wants to talk about anything. And we'll have to see what happens. I mean, you know, there's every week there's a new rumor, you know, about, oh, no, Xi Jinping is not really in control and people are moving against him. But there's never any hard evidence of this. It's just whatever the new rumor is. And I don't know how it will turn out. I just hope that, you know, China can make whatever transition it does make when there's some sort of political change without any bloodshed.
Mm. Okay, well, lots of food for thought there, Joe. I suppose maybe we should wrap up there. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Now, last thing to say from me is thanks very much for everyone listening, and please join us again soon for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts.